Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Microsoft, who of course make a very popular piece of enterprise software called Solitaire. Microsoft's Mike Reavy, who runs the Microsoft Security Response Center, will be popping in at the end of this week's show for our weekly sponsor interview. But in this edition, of this edition, we take a look at some particularly effective strategies for owning companies via social engineering attacks perpetrated over sites like Facebook. So sort of doing a spear phishing attack once you've built up a bit of trust. We used to have security companies warning us about employees posting sensitive information online, which I always thought was a bit of a wishy-washy threat, to be honest. But some guys from the Snowsoft research team recently posted a blog entry about an attack they performed over Facebook that was in fact pretty interesting. Melbourne-based Chief Security Officer Adam Poynton will be along shortly to discuss Snowsoft's attack. But first, it's on to the news segment, and this week's guest is Adam Boileau, KiwiCon organiser, Winlock Pwn and SSH Jack creator. And he joins me on the line now from Middle Earth. Adam, howdy.
Hey, Pat. How's things?
Mate, they are good, despite the fact that this podcast is late, so apologies to the listeners for that. But there's a lot of news to cover. I guess the first thing on our agenda today is that there's been some O-Day in Excel and O-Day in Acrobat, and there's just O-Day everywhere.
Well, I think that's a great thing if you're an attacker these days, huh? People are still finding plenty of zero day. What I think is probably the most interesting about this is, we are starting to see people actually using zero day in the wild rather than, giving it to the vendors or, otherwise wasting it.
Yeah.
And what I like about these, the news stories that have come up around the Excel bugs and the Acrobat one is that the articles all say, oh, it's okay, it's only being used for targeted exploitation.
That's a good thing. It's great unless you're the target.
Well, exactly.
that's another thing that struck me about the last round of O-Days that went out. That big Microsoft, I can't even remember what it was in, but there was an O-Day last year. You remember the big one towards the end of last year that was just being exploited left, right, and center. And that's because the exploit wound up being sold more or less by accident to a group of people for $600 who just started using it to install a widespread Trojan. And that created this huge media sensation. I actually got contacted by the Age newspaper and asked to comment on that. And I just said to them, look, it's really quite funny that people are kicking up a stink about this just because it's being widely exploited. The fact is that vulnerability was being used in a targeted way for God knows how long. And that's probably a much worse situation when you don't actually know about it.
Absolutely, because then it's also less likely to get patched, and more likely in terms of actual damage to be something that you should worry about.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like we're still... Microsoft has actually patched that Excel flaw. We're still waiting on the Adobe Acrobat flaw. That patch is due on the 11th of March. They did just patch another flaw in Flash, though. So busy week for security.
Say it ain't so.
Well, yeah, it's a busy... That's the most commonly installed software on the planet, Flash, because it's on mobile devices. It used to ship with IE as a plugin by default as well, and it's cross-platform, so that's a pretty big deal. But yeah, so lots of O-Day everywhere, so watch your client-side stuff.
Yeah, and I guess this is really a vision of what we're going to see more and more of in the future, when bugs are worth much more than full disclosure. This is the way things are going to be, I predict.
Yeah, I think it's the way things already are, to be honest. Now, look, in this next piece, it briefly looked like that NASA hacker, the guy who got done for hacking into all of these NASA systems using default passwords, it looked like he was getting a bit of political support in the UK because, of course, the US is trying to extradite him over there to charge him under much stiffer anti-terrorism laws. And he's been resisting, obviously, that extradition. It looked like he was getting some political support. That political support has now evaporated, with UK authorities deciding not to charge him in the UK, which makes it much more likely that the extradition will proceed.
Now, that's really rough. Eh? I mean, it's not like the guy really is the biggest threat on the internet, to paraphrase one of our friends.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to contrast the New Zealand case of Akil, the botnet herding guy. He ends up getting a slap on the wrist from the judge and a job offer from the police and an endorsement gig from a managed security provider. Maybe that's a better way to deal with these sort of things.
Yeah, and I saw him at KiwiCon and he was like 11. But there's also this, look, the other thing, you know, with this Gary McKinnon thing is he wasn't a particularly skilled attacker from what I can gather. He was mostly getting in through default passwords and stuff like that. So I don't think NASA and the US Army, Navy and Air Force have really anyone to blame but themselves for
And if that's the worst problem that they've got, you know, that they're trying to extradite the guy for guessing their default passwords, I mean, really, they should be spending their resources a little more effectively, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, by maybe changing, you know, username, admin, password, password.
Yeah, well, Cisco, Cisco.
Nice one. All right, so this next story, look, you know, I don't even want to discuss the specifics of this story, but there's been a stack of new payment card processors get owned. It looks like just every week where we're hearing of more, either more processors or more merchants. There's been a few merchants in the US. There was one in at a Best Buy store, one at a Wyndham Hotel in Florida, and a US government travel website. I mean, they had trouble with their job website over there, which was outsourced to Monster. I mean, there's just data loss is just, I mean, it's going berserk, isn't it?
Well, I don't think this is anything we don't expect. I mean, I'm sure all of these data breaches were happening. It's just we're beginning to actually hear about them, you know, in the press now, rather than them just being covered up, which I think is a good thing. You know, I'm not convinced that there's actually more data breaches going on. We're just hearing about them finally.
Yeah, look, I wonder about that myself. I think the problem might be getting worse, actually. I mean, I would hazard a guess that an element of this is due to the public disclosure laws. But I really do think it's on the up and up, and I'm really starting to question the viability of the credit card model for payments, you know, looking, say, 5 years in the future.
Well, I mean, you know, PCI DSS, I think, is good in that it is helping some of these, you know, merchants and card processors to begin to take security seriously. But I'm not sure how effective it is really in making a difference to them. So, yeah, we may have to see some changes in the business models around it.
Yeah, look, I don't know that PCI DSS, I don't know that we can call it a success, and I don't know that we can say that it's working, because for everyone who applies it properly, there's someone who's not. So, you know...
Well, and even the people who do get their PCI certification, I mean, I know I did a job once where I was reviewing a Unix box that had just been PCI certified by somebody else, and I found 100,000 plain text credit card numbers in a file in Flash Temp.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I mean, that's what I mean. Like, it's just, you can't... You can mandate whatever standard you want, but at the end of the day, I mean, there's just so much of this data out there in so many different hands that I just don't think it's ever. I don't think we're ever going to reach a stage where it's going to be more than trivial to get a hold of this sort of information.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hopefully public reporting, you know, will start to give us a better handle on the size of the problem.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll see, and we're going to see here in Australia whether or not we get those laws. It's looking more and more likely. Now, in this next piece, now this is just an interesting little twist on phishing. It's called smishing. Someone's dubbed it smishing, which is sending SMS phishers, which ask people to verify their accounts via a 888 phone number. So it sends them a text saying, you know, we're from Keypoint Credit Union. You need to ring and enter in your details, your social security number, credit card number, all of that sort of stuff. And it looks like they're having some success with this scam.
Well, I'm sure, you know, any scam of a good size is going to find some suckers somewhere. But I think probably the important thing that we take away from this is that any time you're designing a new communications technology, we should name it such that you can't put ishing on the end of it.
Yes. Or just ing, perhaps, you know, because we've got farming as well, you know, all that sort of stuff. At least it doesn't have a ph in it.
Yeah, but it's got two s's.
And a shing. Yeah, no, you're right. But look, I think the other thing to take away from this too is that I would hazard a guess that people would be more likely to get suckered in by some sort of SMS-based scam rather than an email scam, because it's just fresh territory.
Well, I suppose the carriers have always been very keen on presenting this walled garden model for cellular services, so people do trust for cell phone content more than they would the regular internet. And I suppose this is a good reminder that's not actually the case.
Okay. In this next story, which comes from cnetnews.com, it's a write-up of a survey that was commissioned by Symantec. So I guess we've got to take this one with a grain of salt.
Set off the vendor klaxon right now.
Yeah, exactly. But of 950 people that they surveyed who'd lost or left their jobs during the last 12 months, nearly 60% admitted to taking confidential company information with them. Now, that's a pretty high stat, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is, but I'm not sure that's related to technology. I'm sure, you know, people who leave, you know, businesses that don't use technology probably experience a very similar level of data loss from disgruntled or fired employees.
Well, 82% of the respondents said their employers did not perform an audit or review of documents before the employee headed out the door, and 24% said they still had access to the corporate network after leaving the building. So we're talking printed documents, we're talking credentials there as well. Interestingly, 53% said they downloaded the information onto a CD or a DVD and walked it out. 42% put it on a USB drive, and 38% sent it as attachments via email. So, you know, I would suspect that Symantec commissioned this study to perhaps bolster interest in their DLP products. But, you know, it looks pretty compelling, to be honest, doesn't it?
Well, yes. But then, I mean, do we really believe that DLP is good for preventing deliberate data loss? I mean, they market it for stopping accidental leaks. But against a deliberate, person trying to get the data out who already has access to the internal network, I'm not sure that the DLP products are really going to be very effective.
Well, I don't think the DLP product could stop you from doing it, but also one stat that they didn't include is that 95% of respondents were idiots. you know what I mean? So yeah. I think for most people who'd sort of fumble around and try to get the data off, they'd probably set off a few alarm bells via DLP software before they got shown the door.
And they'll sit in the IDS console for the next 3 months until someone looks at them, right?
Yeah, pretty much. When they stop playing Xbox and finally decide to review some logs. Look, this next one's straight. It's mega cloak and dagger. It comes via Wired.com's 27B or whatever blog, their security blog. The head of the Internet Monitoring Department of Beijing's Municipal Public Safety Bureau was arrested on suspicion of taking more than $5.8 million in bribes to help an antivirus company defeat its competitor.
You know, for a communist country, they really have taken to capitalism very well.
Well, we call it free market communism. But this is the head of the Great Firewall of China being bribed to basically fabricate evidence against the rival of the guy who was paying him. I mean, it's just fascinating, isn't it?
Well, it's a reasonable amount of money. You know, $5.8 million, that's a fair amount of bribe. You could buy a lot of flash cars for that.
Yeah, look, the whole thing stemmed from rivalry between two antivirus vendors called MicroPoint and Rising. So things got pretty bitter, and one of them wound up being framed for a bunch of stuff, and he spent 11 months in prison on the charges.
Yeah, that's rough.
It is rough. So now there's a countersuit and this and that, but there you go. I mean, you know, you introduce something like a great firewall for any nation, and I guess this is the sort of abuse that you can expect.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, anything with that kind of money floating around, it's serious business, as we say, on the internet.
Yes, serious business. And I tell you what, I wouldn't want to be pinged for corruption in China, because I have a feeling that guy is going to be amply punished.
Sliced and diced.
Exactly. Now, spam. The guy who hacked Miley Cyrus's MySpace account and the MySpace accounts of a whole bunch of celebrities was actually using them to spam.
that's kind of interesting. I mean, you think if you were, you just wanted to spam, you go hire a Russian botnet or roll your own rather than using Miley Cyrus's MySpace. It does seem a little perverted.
It was some sort of marketing scheme where basically he was just trying to get people to hit a link. So, of course, once he had access to all of these celebrities, communication channels, imagine if I took over Barack Obama's Twitter account and then said, check out these sunglasses or something. There would be plenty of people dumb enough to not realize that was obviously a spam thing and click through to it. So
sounds like you got a business model there.
Yeah, maybe we should talk after the show. But yeah, this kid is 19 and he's been well and truly busted. And he's in a bit of trouble. So he's admitted to everything by the looks of things. And he's just waiting to see what the authorities want to do with him. But there you go.
Have a rough time.
Yeah, I don't think he's in for a pleasant experience. In other news, a group of US government security organizations has actually come up with a list of 20 security actions that they say are really, really good. Is this just another stupid standard that no one's going to use, Adam?
Well, I think the list is quite a good list. I mean, it's comprehensive. It covers up everything you need. And I suppose it's nice to have it enumerated for you. But really, if you're in a position to do all of those things and do them well, then you probably don't need the list, I'm not sure that anyone is capable of doing everything that they are describing in that list and doing it well. And the temptation with a list like that is people are going to want to then buy compliance with it, buy a piece of software that does the top 20 this or the top 10 that. And I'm not sure that the compliance software you would buy or the tools that you would use, for example, the inventory or your hardware and software are actually not going to make things worse. We see this all the time with centralized management tools and inventorying tools. they usually, you know, they run as domain admin, they have, you know, shatter attack privilege escalation on them, they update themselves poorly without checking signatures, and in the end we end up owning the environment through these management tools rather than actually having them provide any meaningful improvement.
So you think this list is basically going to open the door for a bunch of vendors to come up with a solution that says, hey, look, we can make you comply with these 20 things?
Well, if we had a vendor that could do that, then they might have some opportunities in the market. But I mean, these are pretty high-level recommendations in some cases, you know, like have good network admins.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's not rocket science.
Don't get pwned.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's good stuff to look over, I guess, but I wouldn't take it, you know, real serious, like, and, you know, tick off each entry.
Well, there is a copy of this thing floating around on the SANS website. I think it's at sans.org/CAG or CAG. So there you go. Anyone who's interested can check that out. Now, look, in this late breaking news, I have here a media release from Senator Joe Ludwig here in Australia, who is warning people of a phishing scam that is targeting the recipients of these cash bonuses the Australian government is handing out in order to stimulate the economy. So this is a great sign of how sort of adaptable and sort of on the pulse most scammers are.
Yeah, well, you're going to keep it topical and fresh. You know, I was hoping that when you emailed me that PDF, it was going to be one of the PDF exploits we were discussing earlier. But, you know, I was disappointed. Either that or you just own my box.
Midget porn, eh?
Damn.
I'm in your home, dear.
Yeah, I'm just cringing now. Just cringing.
But, yeah, no, it's just interesting that this scam's going around. And, you know, the Australian government has decided in its wisdom to basically give everyone in the country $900. So this email is going around saying, look, if you want your $900, you've got to go and fill in all of your bank account details here and you'll get it. So, yeah, sign of the times, global financial cluster phishing attempts.
Yeah, well, you know, if the economy goes down, I guess crime goes up, right? And that's hopefully good for our line of work.
I was going to say, hopefully, God willing. okay, that's it for the news. Adam Boileau, thanks a lot for taking some time out to speak to us, as always.
Thanks very much, Pat.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with this week's news. Anyway, next up, it's time to have a chat with Adam Poynton, a Melbourne-based CSO of a publicly listed financial services company down there. Now, there's been a fairly interesting blog post doing the rounds of late, which was written by the guys who call themselves Snowsoft, or the Snowsoft team. And I'll post a link to that blog post along with the podcast so you can have a look at it yourself if you're interested. Now, the post describes an attack by a pen testing team on an unnamed organization that was done through Facebook. And what these guys did is they set up a profile for a completely fictitious, attractive 28-year-old who purported to work for the target organization. We'll call her Alice. Even though no one had ever actually seen this woman walking around the office, it wasn't actually too hard to make friends within that company, like co-workers and stuff. So the team added a stack of friends from the target organization and actively engaged with other staff through the social networking site. So they really did build up that trust. Now, then came the attack. They found a cross-site scripting flaw in the client's website, which allowed them to create a perfectly looking legitimate form that looked like it came from the target's own web server. Now, the form asked users to perform a password reset, entering their existing login and password information, which is, of course, the juicy information that they were after. So, of course, Alice then sent a message out to all of her friends in the company saying, oh my God, it looks like we got hacked. You have to go and reset your password. And voila, within a few minutes, they had VPN access to the target and the test was a success. Adam Poynton joins me on the line now to discuss. And Adam, this is a great little case study on how social networking sites actually present a tangible threat to enterprise security. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. So it's a great place for the social engineer to perform reconnaissance and hoard individuals to then target with a focused attack. It gives the social engineer person a good case to pretext and to, you know, as you said, build trust and create trust as a so-called employee of the target organization. And then they're just ready and waiting to do whatever the social engineer wants to get out of the attack.
Now, of course, being a journalist, you know, we used to get pitched. Of course, you know, Facebook was a bit behind in Australia. It took off a bit later. And when it did, you know, we got so many press releases saying Facebook's a security risk because people post valuable company information and stuff. And I, you know, that's the reconnaissance angle. And I got to be honest and say, I never really bought that as a sort of high priority threat that people should be concerned about. But this looks I mean, it looks like a pretty fail-safe way to trick people, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's what they basically did was get into the organization or make it appear to the other employees of the organization that they were a trusted entity, an internal employee. You know, they talked about work-based things and projects that other people had been talking about in the company Facebook group setup.
Where
they were talking about internal projects and things like that, and they just sort of went along with it and managed to build up the trust and then just tricked the users into going to something that, you know, was sensational, like, you know, claiming that their website had been hacked.
Yeah, now I guess really the question is, what can you do about it? I mean, short of actually just blocking Facebook, and I'm sure that's going to be your answer. But short of doing that, I mean, is this something you can fix through policy? Because it strikes me that, you know, it's not something that would be easy to fix through user education because, you know, people tend to resist being schooled in these in such things. But is it something that you could fix with policy? So no discussion of work-related things in, you know, online groups. Do not identify yourself as an employee of our company when you put your Facebook profile up. Only post to forums with, you know, Gmail accounts, things like that. Does that work?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I see a lot of. People just, as you say, block Facebook entirely and block MySpace and whatever else. But the threat's been around for a while. I mean, you look back and IT developers or whoever working on IT projects will post questions into technical forums like, hey, I'm doing this with my code. I can't quite get it to do that. And somebody will post back saying, oh, why don't you just use this? Show me the sample. And, you know, you get people posting code and things like that. And that gives a social engineer the opportunity to focus on that user or obviously get information from their source code or whatever. But yeah, with Facebook, you can block it entirely. But I mean, the person may still have access from home. They may still talk about where they work and you know, your PA at home may still say that they work for company ABC. So the risk is still there. As you say, it has to be addressed through user education. You know, trust nobody. Don't post on forums. Use Gmail. You know, don't talk about secret projects, but don't even associate yourself or your identity with the company. But it comes also to user education about general protection of their identity. You know, if they put their full date of birth on Facebook and things like that, they're subject to personality or identity theft themselves, let alone a company threat. So that sometimes works with users because they actually prick up their ears and listen to that and say, oh, right, okay, you know, identity theft, I've heard about that. It's not just talking about company secrets. It's, you know, they personally could have their lives adversely affected by posting silly things.
Yeah, no, that's the old, you know, the old privacy debate. It's interesting what you said about code sharing before because I would imagine that if you were just doing that from a Gmail account, you know, under an assumed name, that it would be quite safe.
Well, I mean, technical people, they don't always do that. You know, we certainly encourage people to use, you know, anonymous accounts and things like that and don't associate their identity or code or whatever with company assets or information. But you see it happen. You know, sometimes they'll post a code snippet and it's from an anonymous account. But if you actually look at it, you can still work out and determine where it came from. Mm. You know, they may not change variable names. They may have, you know, comments in there from users with an email address, something as obvious as that. But again, that's the kind of half-trained, half-cautious user. But your PA is not going to be that paranoid. You know, they are going to post questions or put information out there.
My PA doesn't exist, unfortunately, but that would be nice. That would be a good problem to have, worrying about my PA's exposure on Facebook. But, you know, the other thing too is, you know, we've sort of discussed here that you could forbid people from associating their identity or their personal identity with their professional identity. But still, I mean, that just, to me, that just seems that you just have to add a bit of recon work to actually figure out who works at that company. And then, you know, you can still infiltrate them through the social network by just by working out who they are. You just get their name and where they live, the city where they live, and it shouldn't be too hard to find them.
But it's kind of as equivalent as the typical more manual social engineer person who will call up and say, who's the IT manager? And then they'll call up the one digit phone number next to them and ask them for, you know, for Bob, or go through the help desk, or go through the more sort of traditional social engineer methods of getting somebody to do something. The Facebook way is great because, as you say, it builds the web of trust and allows you to sort of set up great pretext before the engineer sort of does the attack. But blocking things like that and getting people to be careful of their identity and association with the organization, it does make it harder and does make it more of a detailed investigative work to get that attack vector, where they may just pick up the phone and go, the semi-old school method and try and get through that way.
Well, that is harder. I mean, the other thing that strikes me about this attack is that it's a really good demonstration of why cross-site scripting flaws are actually kind of, kind of pretty bad in this context.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, it was good that they, there were no SSL warnings or anything like that, but people still actively fished out there and users still, go through and believe whatever they're seeing. And if the site's so-called hacked and it's made sensational enough, then the users will fall for it.
So you say that that was sort of almost an unnecessary step there, that people still would have provided login details had it have not appeared to come from the company's own website.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it was good that they made a nice, smooth process, and there were no warnings to the user or nothing sort of looked out of the ordinary. But my gut feeling would be if they were sent to some .ru website that, had the company's logo in the corner, they probably still would have put the password in. Perhaps not the guy who commissioned the work. Might have sort of noticed. But of the other people, I'm sure at least one person would have put their username and password in. Hence the current phishing problem that we get. Phishing is it does work. People are actively phishing people and it does work across the world. Stats sort of say that and prove that and, yeah, you definitely see it.
Well, I think it comes down to there's a sucker born every minute.
That's right. And as a security test that I did, 5, 6, 7 years ago, we used a reputable online webmail account that looked safe enough, and we used social engineering over the voice to talk to one of the people in the IT group and say that there are important documents we needed to deliver to them that would have impacted their fiber connectivity because we're going to cut a trench in the backyard, basically, and we said we were from a carrier.
And, this wouldn't be the fact that Telstra still issues email addresses from webmail from @telstra.com, would it?
Yeah, it's something around that. It's very convenient. and, of course, something coming from Telstra.com to somebody who's already been pretext and warned that they may lose their fibre connectivity, which is obviously painful to the comms manager, they're more than happy to open up a self-extracting executable with, the Telstra plans about what they're going to do in your backyard.
I remember that one. That was pretty sweet.
Yeah, and again, that was, arguably that was kind of a cross-site scripting kind of vulnerability because it was across the main. It appeared to come from Telstra. The IT manager was able to send back to that address and then receive another email from that. So it just built up that web of trust as well.
Note to Telstra, having anonymous webmail from @telstra.com, not a good idea. And note to communications managers who may be listening, unless it's from @team.telstra.com, it's from a webmail account.
That's right. And even if it does come from team.telstra.com, it doesn't actually mean that somebody from team.telstra.com sent it.
Well, it could be forged,
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's just, phishing and targeted attacks and social engineering aspects.
So then, hang on. I mean, surely then blocking Facebook isn't really going to achieve much because someone will just find another way of using that social vector. I mean, surely you've really got to have some pretty rigid policies and some pretty decent user education.
That's right. That's right. It's just that blocking Facebook, prevents the kind of automatic assumed leakage of information and people posting about company matters and whatnot. And, user education to stop people posting to forums using their identity, and that is all needed. But blocking Facebook or sort of, common places where this information is just leaked or lost or posted up there to the internet is definitely a good thing.
Yeah, I always find it funny, actually, when people argue for the blocking of Facebook along productivity concerns, because they say, until Facebook came along, everyone was so productive and just sitting there tapping away, working harmoniously with each other, and when in fact they actually just played solitaire. And, Facebook gave them something else to do, but people will always find a way to slack off.
Definitely.
All right. All right, Adam. Well, I think that'll do it on this topic, mate, but thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to have a chat to us.
Yep, all right, cheers.
Adam Poynton on the line from Melbourne there. And also, after we did the interview, Adam asked me to add a couple of things. He says, blocking Facebook and other social networking sites is also effective in preventing an external assessment of internal relationships, if that makes sense. And he says this also applies to LinkedIn, which he says is a great place to do a bit of recon. So there you go, a couple of extra notes from Adam there. Next up, it's time to have a chat with the head of Microsoft Security Response Center, Mike Reavy. Microsoft are, of course, a sponsor, and each week our sponsors get to come onto the show for a chinwag. Now, this week I thought it might be interesting to talk to Mike about Microsoft's relatively recent exploitability index. We've all seen their bulletin severity rankings, you know, critical, moderate, and whatnot. But they copped a lot of flack over the years from all sorts of people who said that that didn't provide enough information on the actual level of risk. So these days, Microsoft will tell you how likely they think it is that the given bug will be exploited. And it's called the Exploitability Index. And Mike joins me now to discuss it. So, Mike, can you explain the rationale behind introducing the Exploitability Index in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. So, just to kind of cover what the Exploitability Index is, it's just the goal of it is to provide more information to customers so they can prioritize the updates that we release on the second Tuesday of each month. And kind of the story behind it is we were looking at trends and the vulnerabilities that we fix year over year, and how many of those vulnerabilities, once they're published and once the fixes are published, how many of those actually get exploited. And what we saw, and this is, you know, the vulnerabilities are fully public, and we know that there's a community of people that reverse engineer our updates and put out proof of concept code following the second Tuesday. And even with that community doing that work, there's about a 30-70 split. So about 30% of the vulns actually get exploit code released, and 70 never do. And we kind of took that as an indicator, dug into it a little bit further to try and understand why. And there's a bunch of different factors that can go into why a vulnerability actually has exploit code or not. But one thing we did notice was there are some vulnerabilities that just by their nature are much harder to exploit because of the way that the vulnerability manifests itself in the code. And so the thought was, is there a way that we could provide that information to customers? So if they're looking at, you know, let's say a month when there's five bulletins and there's three criticals, once they've gone through and done analysis of their environment and said, okay, these are the most, you know, important bulletins to me based off the products I have in my environment, even then, if they wanted to pick just the most important, could we give them some more information that would let them do that based off what we think the likelihood of exploit code being released would be?
So I guess really the rationale was just about giving people more information on how to prioritize updates.
Absolutely.
Okay. Because you guys used to get a lot of flack as well for, I mean, perceived misclassification of vulnerabilities. You'd call something, you know, medium or something like that, and then it would later turn out to be critical. Do you worry that the same sort of mistakes could be made under the new regime?
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime you try and measure something in the security ecosystem, which is pretty diverse, it's going to be challenging to make it right for all scenarios. I think a couple of the reasons why we're feeling pretty good about Exploitability Index is, one, we have a fair amount of history as far as what types of vulnerabilities get exploited and what don't, and so we're leveraging that in the creation of the index each month. And two, we actually are using the community. So it's not just Microsoft trying to understand this whole situation ourselves. We do have the Microsoft Active Protections Program, which is a group of security protection providers. I think right now we have 28. And every month we give them information about the vulnerabilities so they can have protections out. And as part of that, we ask them to check our work on the Exploitability Index. And so therefore, we have, you know, kind of two ways to go look at it. One is, you know, what do we think given our history and given, you know, working on the issue since it was reported? And two, what do others think?
Now, the old scale was very linear, you know, there was just one sort of reading on it. I must admit that I'm not overly familiar with the new regime, but do you sort of give it different rankings in different categories? Is it a multi-criteria reading? Is it a multi-criteria sort of threat assessment, or is it you still just get one rating at the end?
Yeah, I mean, well, what you get one rating for the Exploitability Index, and you get one of three values for it. But if you're a customer and you want to try and paint a strong picture of what your risk is, now you have two things that you can use. One is the bulletin severity rating, which tells a customer if you had a highly motivated attacker that could carry out an exploit, here's the worst it would be. And then you have the exploitability index, which says, what do we think is going to happen if by the ecosystem as a whole? Is somebody actually going to go through and try and carry this out to the maximum impact?
So it's really trying to determine an actual outcome, is it? So instead of determining the sort of hypothetical worst, you're really looking at the likelihood of this thing actually being exploited in the wild.
Absolutely. Within that first, in that critical first 30 days when the updates are released and customers are really trying to maximize their resources and make those prioritization decisions, giving them that information about what do we think is actually going to happen in that window of time.
Does it concern you that in this day and age, the fact that customers still have to actually prioritize patching is a reality? I mean, surely it should be a process that you wouldn't need to prioritize. It should just be so simple that you don't even think about it, right?
Yeah, I think that for a lot of customers, it is, right? We have automatic updates that's enabled by default on the modern OS for most customers, and there's not a whole lot of user interaction even required there. But for some enterprise customers where they've got unique line of business systems or they have a pretty diverse environment, every bit of information for them counts. And that's the feedback we get from them is, you know, give us more information, let us make smart decisions. And so the exploitability index is just another way that we're trying to address that customer ask.
Have there been many criticisms of the new program since it was introduced?
You know, not too much. So far, we're doing pretty solid. To date, we haven't had one rating that we had to go back and change because we got it wrong. And one of our goals is with the index, what we don't want to do, and you sort of mentioned this a little bit about the bulletin severity ratings, what we don't want to do is say this vulnerability won't get exploited and have it be exploited. And since we launched this in October, that hasn't happened.
Yeah, well, that must be a relief.
Yeah, I think it is a relief, and it's a function of the process, right? By one, you know, bringing our guys in from the beginning to make that assessment, and two, by sharing the information with the community right before we release it of protection providers. Hmm. We think we have a pretty solid process to check our work.
Now, I understand also that you guys had Immunity look over this new regime. What was the rationale behind getting them to do that in the first place?
Yeah, so, you know, Immunity and Microsoft actually have some of the same goals when it comes to giving customers more information about security threats. So recognizing that and recognizing that they've been an important player in sort of the exploitation community, we thought it would be a good idea to have them do a review of the exploitability index concept as a whole, see if there was value in it, and then let our customers see that as well. Sort of just getting some third-party commentary on the idea.
It seemed a little bit unusual to my eyes to see Immunity and Microsoft being quite cozy because, I mean, back in the day, Immunity would never actually pre-disclose vulnerabilities it found in your products to Microsoft. It would just go ahead and send them out to its subscribers. Has that policy of theirs changed or...?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we certainly encourage responsible disclosure, and we also work really hard with the broader community to have issues reported to us in a responsible way. And we partnered with Immunity through several things over the years, working to understand each other's common interests. This is certainly one. I think there was some training at Black Hat where we did a defend the flag concept where we tried to harden some Windows systems and then using Immunity tools see if people could break into them. So I think it's all part of the, security is a pretty tough problem. We realize we can't do it by ourselves, so we'll engage smart people wherever we can.
Is it a case of keep your friends close and your enemies closer?
Oh, I certainly wouldn't say it's exactly like that. But, I mean, one of the things that's interesting is it's a pretty dynamic community, right? So even though there's some banter about the relationship between Immunity and Microsoft in overall, you step back and you look at something like Exploitability Index, you can see where we both have the same goal. We want customers to have the right information so they can make good decisions.
Well, I don't think anyone would argue that Microsoft hasn't come a very long way over the last 5 or 6 years.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's great.
What has the feedback from customers been? I mean, are they actually really using this? Because I imagine you would have done a little bit of research and a little bit of outreach to find out precisely how applied the new index is.
Yeah, I mean, we're actually getting feedback as of this month. I mean, Patch Tuesday was this Tuesday of this week, and on some of the bulletins released, there was questions on, what is the exploitability index rating? We went back to it, and in the webcast, reminded folks, you know, the Internet Explorer issues had a setting of 1. And so just based off the touching that we do of customers after every release, we're getting questions, we're getting feedback, and the overall consensus is. They appreciate more information.
Okay, Mike Reavy, thanks a lot for your time.
All right, thank you.
Microsoft's Mike Reavy on the line there from the USA. And before we go this week, it's time for a check of this week's audio mailbag. And we've had but one single message from Pedro, who dialed in on our USA number.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Pedro, and Risky Business is an excellent show. I listen to it every week to keep up with security in general. Keep up the great work, Patrick. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Pedro. It's very good of you to say. If you have any feedback, good or bad, please do ring our voicemail boxes and leave a message. You can call Sydney on 02-8569-1835 or the USA toll-free on 877-688-8417. And that's pretty much it for this week. I'd like to say a special hello to Rob from the Sunshine Coast. I was in a remote part of Western Tasmania last week. As you do, when I met Rob and his partner randomly, and it was a bit of a spin out for both of us because it turns out he's a listener. So if you've ever been to Western Tasmania, you'd understand why that's a bit of a surprise, running into someone down there who's... yes, g'day, Rob. Good to meet you. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Yeah.